Wow, this is awesome. And later I'm going to go lift free weights in a parking lot.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast for another week. This is the second last episode for our year coming up. And really fortunate to have a legend of strength and conditioning in Victorian basketball in particular, but also everywhere else around the country. Darren McInnes is going to join us on the podcast in just a little bit. Just a couple of reminders before we jump into it. As always, Talking Split socials, at Talking Split, Instagram, and on X. You can follow along, new drills, podcasts, videos of our coaches coaching, videos of our players playing. We're going to try and use that as a little bit of a resource hub for coaching development and inspiration moving forward. So where we can, we're going to try and post as much stuff on there that can help you out as coaches. If there's anything you're looking for on there, please do hit us up, and we'll see if we can get some eyes on it, some recording on it of some sort, and get it on there for you. So we do want to try and help out as much as we possibly can with that. This is not just trying to get our Instagram followers up, because God knows that's not going to happen, but it is one of those areas where we want to try and help out as many coaches as possible. So if you can give us a like, a share, a subscribe, all of that cool stuff that goes with anything social media related, that would be fantastic to just try and help spread the word a little bit more and help out coaches around the place. Just a reminder as well, next week is our last week for the year. So podcast recording will be a mailbag segment. Any questions you might have, send them through. You can either do it on, of course, the Talking Split socials, or you can just send us an email and we'll try and get to that over the course of that mailbag segment. We've got a few sitting there already. We'll also put the story out on Instagram so you can have a little bit of a play around with that as to what you might want to send in. You can go something Christmas themed if you want. You can go something very specific to you. You can go something way out of left field if you want, like Coops's best DJ tracks to get a party started. If that's what you want to go with, no problems at all. But what we will get into right now is our chat with Darren McInnes, who was kind enough to spend a lot of time with us and answer some of the questions that got sent in by the listeners over the course of the last week. Many of you will know Darren from around the place. He's worked with Basketball Victoria for over a decade now in the strength and conditioning department in particular. He's at Core Advantage, just continuing the whole Core Advantage empire continues to grow, whether it be athletes coming out of there, interns coming out of there and helping in the coaching space with S&C as well. Darren puts a world of work into this, and you can obviously follow along with all of Core Advantage's comings and goings on their social media accounts as well. So Darren will hit on those towards the end of the podcast for those of you that are interested, but would highly recommend getting a little bit of awareness around what can potentially the S&C side of things look like for our players. Darren's also going to send through a whole bunch of notes that we'll put in the show notes for this episode as well. So there's some resources that he'll talk about during the pod that we'll just drop into the show notes and you can go and find those to your heart's content from there. So I'd like to welcome in Darren McInnes from Core Advantage. So Darren was on our second ever Talking Split episode.
Really?
And we are 146 deep now. It's like the Beatles back catalogue. We've been around for a while now. So Darren, brilliant to have you in. When we talk S&C, you are the first person we always think of. Like your history in basketball, strength and conditioning in particular is one of the most impressive ones that we've ever seen. But the amount of care and work you put into it in particular is what we love about it, which is why we keep coming back to you for these sorts of things. So brilliant to have you in.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
It was one of those ones where as soon as we threw out what are the questions for Darren, they came in quick. So the first one we actually had when we talk S&C in particular is, what is the point of a hinge? Or what is a hinge for those that may not be across that even?
Yeah, sure. So we had a bunch of the athletes the hinge at the MPP camp. And so yep. There's footage for that. So if you're running What is a Hinge, have a look on the Instagram. You can see me demoing a hinge. Hinge is really important movement. If you're going to go anywhere in the gym, you're going to need to learn how to hinge, because it's the foundation of a good deadlift, a good trap bar deadlift, and a bunch of other things. It's just good to have that control and do a good RDL, all these different variations. So it's important in the gym in an indirect way, just to get your body stronger. It's a good movement to have, because you want everyone to have a really good squat and a really good hinge and to know the difference, because they're actually completely different patterns. Sure. If you don't know the difference, what the problem is often you end up doing, your squat looks a bit like a hinge, your hinge looks a bit like a squat, and it's all the same thing. Yeah. And what I want is I want our athletes to have a really deadlifty deadlift. Not off the floor, not with a straight bar, with a trap bar, but still it's a deadlifty shape with that hingy shape. And then a really squatty squat. So it's actually hitting the target tissue. So you're not ending up just halfway between both. Reality is eventually you do get to do a trap bar deadlift, which is a bit of a squatty hinge, but you want people to be able to distinguish between those different kind of flavors of the movements. Yep. So it's really important in the gym. But on court, it's mission critical, because if you don't have a good hinge, you actually can't get into a decent athletic stance. So time and time again, you see athletes who they think they're getting into a good attacking triple threat, but they're actually kind of in double threat, because the threat to blow by their player isn't there because they're too upright.
Yep.
And so you've got to be able to hinge over just a little bit in order to load the glutes rather than the quads and therefore be able to explode and create that separation from the defensive player. So hinge, yeah, it's one of those ones where once you've got it, like it, you don't. It's like riding a bike. Like once you know how to do that movement, but if you don't, it really does put you at a bit of a disadvantage.
And there is not a coach alive that thinks their players play low enough.
Yeah,
like when you really put it in context, we go, oh, you know, if you just get lower, and that is that a myth? Like, does lower equal faster and quicker, or is it just depend on the movement?
No, lower is almost always better because you can put more force into the ground. You can. Win a wrestling contest. A whole lot of good things happen if you can get low.
Yep.
So it's very, very important. And, you know, the thing is, if you've got a lot of basketballers have got very long femurs, they've got a very long thigh bone.
Yep.
And so what that means is if you just make them do a pure squatty squat on a court, their femur's so long, they end up having to hinge anyway. They end up folding up kind of like a deck chair.
Yeah, gotcha.
So you can either have a crappy, inadvertent, not good hinge, or you can have a deliberate good athletic one where your back's in a good position and you can move athletically. So yeah, if you want someone over 6'2" to be able to get into a deep stance, they've got to have that hinge. Otherwise, the physics of the situation, I mean, they just fall backwards.
Yep.
And they can't stay on their midfoot, they can't stay on the balls of their feet, so they can't be reactive and explosive.
Yeah,
so,
cool. Yeah,
getting low is super, super beneficial.
So there you go, coaches. Stick with. continue demand.
Yeah, great example is this is a long, long time ago, I had an athlete who'd sustained a nasty shoulder injury, and it meant that we couldn't do any upper body stuff. So we just for about 6 weeks were focusing on lower body stuff, in particular wide stance squats, but we couldn't load anything onto his back, so it was just body weight only. And he came back from that injury, and you always expect to be a bit slower when you return from injury and you gradually get better. And he came into the gym, he's like, I can't believe how much quicker I am laterally. And I said, yeah, because we've been focusing heaps on getting low. Like, you're getting the lowest you've ever got now.
Yep.
Definitely low is good.
Excellent. All right, stick with. All right, are plyometrics good? is a real open-ended question. Yeah. Do you want to take us through what plyometrics are in the first place? Like, if we were going to talk about it, what actually are they and are they good?
Yeah. Sure. So plyometrics are an exercise designed to exploit the stretch shortening cycle. So what that is if we go to jump, we lengthen the muscle. So imagine the downward motion of jumping. So you're engaging with the ground and then you're going to explode upwards. So the muscles are going from lengthening to contracting, and that's called the stretch shortening cycle. So there's stretching and then contracting. And in the great athletes, that happens really quick. Like, we've all seen those athletes who are super bouncy, where they have this lovely elastic reaction to the ground where they just hit it and in, you know, like a millionth of a second, they're up and moving. Yeah.
Yep.
And so plyometrics are designed to exploit that mechanism, that reflexive mechanism in the human body, to enable you to jump higher. So plyometrics done correctly are amazing, but it's the done correctly. So
that's the danger.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. One of the things is a lot of the early plyometric stuff was built on research out of Russia during kind of the Cold War period, where they were really investing heavily in their plyometric and their performance-enhancing stuff. And there's a few confounding variables there. One, there was some extracurricular help.
Performance-enhancing stuff, I thought, alluded to that, but I wasn't too sure.
Right. So you can't always judge that as being, you know, gold standard, because you don't know how much of it was the methodology and how much of it was the chemistry.
Yep.
And the other thing is there was a catastrophic miscalculation from Russian into English on one of the key planks of plyometrics.
Yeah, right.
So one of the things was a depth jump, where you stand up on a high box and you jump off the box and you land on the ground, and you land with kind of a squatty absorbing stance, the kind of thing I teach with ninja landing, so soft, stacked and stable, right? So that was the Russian. But that got mistranslated into people in the Western world thinking you're supposed to jump off it and then explode back off the high box, which is actually a different thing. And so there's a lot of people that will say, oh, this is really good for you. It's like, oh, probably actually not super high box jumping is actually not going to be that good for you at all.
Yep.
But a little bit of it, a micro dose of plyometrics of getting less springy athletes, more springy, is really valuable.
Yep.
But I think it always comes back to who's the athlete in front of you. If someone's already phenomenally springy, a big investment in plyometrics, it's not necessarily going to help that much because they're maxing out that quality. But for someone who's less springy, super valuable. There's a good way of distinguishing. I like the distinction between extensive and intensive plyometrics. So extensive would be skipping.
Yep.
So it's lower amplitude. You're not getting as high. It's more kind of capacity building. It's safer. And, you know, extensive plyometrics, like a small dose of extensive is really good for athletes. We've got a little bit of a resource that I'll be able to send to you as well to point people, which has got video on it and so forth.
Awesome.
But, yeah, and then the intensive, I'm not so sure they have as much of a place in junior athletes. What the intensive plyometrics are really good for is making people a lot of money selling programs on the internet.
Yeah, guilty. You know, it's a little bit of a story time, unfortunately, from way back in the day. But yeah, sure, I was scrolling through my usual basketball websites when I was a young, naive teenager, like 19, 20 years old. And it's like, you know what? If I could just make my players jump higher, they'll be better players. Mm. And, you know, did the usual Google search of, hey, you know, best jump program for basketball, and got sent out like a box set of 84 DVDs that if you just follow this program, you'll be a much better jumper at the end of it. It was just myth. Yeah. It's like, oh, you know, put ankle weights on and do this. Oh. It's like, oh, you know, that couldn't be worse for what we actually want out of this. But it is what is out there, I suppose.
Well, and the thing is, it's a product problem in the sense that if you want to charge a decent amount of money for something, generally what you've got to do is you've got to throw a lot of really high level stuff in because it looks like you're buying a Porsche. Yep. Like you want the high specs, but most kids don't need the high specs. They need just the basics. We're actually in the process. We've got the reverse of that. And we're calling it the Boring Plyos program.
Yep.
So that'll be coming relatively soon. And that's it's in reaction to that. It's like, we know people are going to do plyos.
Yep.
Let's have them at least do safe, intelligent, progressive ones.
I like it.
So, and for the moment, yeah, just the free resource we'll send you just has a little bit of pogos. Pogos are amazing. So pogos are kind of like skipping, but you've taken the coordination out of it. Because, you know, one of the big things that trips people up with skipping is they've got to do all the arm stuff and it distracts you from achieving the stimulus. So if you can skip, it's good. But for a lot of tall, slightly unco athletes, that ends up being the blocker. And so they actually don't get the qualities we're chasing as much. Whereas pogos are great because you get that bounce and they can be progressed and you can do them anywhere. You've got land and gravity. So
cool.
Micro-dosed plyos are a great idea.
Yep.
I would say too, I think there's a great trend at the moment in strength and conditioning, which is to make your high days high and your low days low. And what that means is let's try and, you know, it used to be that people would kind of spread the workout over every day.
Yep.
But that means you're working hard every day, so you're not really allowing any recovery. So what's gaining traction now is the idea of, well, if Monday was going to be a day of high work, maybe we could move some of Tuesday's work into Monday and then make Tuesday a genuine low day, a genuine recovery day to get that adaptation from the stimulus. So I think that's worth thinking about when it comes to the plyos as well. So you might do a pinch of them at Monday night training. You've done your warm-up and then you might do 3 minutes of plyos at the start of the training rather than doing them on the Tuesday.
Yep. Like it. So you've mentioned skipping a couple of times. So one of the questions we had in is skipping still recommended for under 12 and under 14 girls weekly? Even if we expand that out, boys, girls, different age groups, is skipping worth it?
Yeah, I think a pinch of it can be really worth it.
Yep.
And it can be a fun thing to learn. And I think you're developing that sense of bounce. I think it's good. But like the plyos, it's got to be appropriate. It's got to be done well. I should say too, we alluded to the risk, but we didn't really talk about it with plyos. I had a very high potential athlete. I had a parent come up to me and say they had sustained a stress fracture doing plyos.
Yep.
Because they were 12 years old and doing a program probably that I wouldn't get one of our Opals doing. So it's really important that it be less is more, build up slowly. Don't overcook young athletes with that.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely. So with under 10, under 12, under 14 athletes, should they be doing weights twice per week? Is there an age?
That's a great question.
One of the best ones I hear, does it stunt growth?
Yes.
And I hear that all the time.
Still.
As a question.
Yeah,
still.
It's crazy, isn't it? Yeah. 2024, we're still talking about that. Let's talk about the stunting growth first.
Yep.
So the technical statement, the full statement is correct, which is Olympic lifting with really heavy weights did stunt some athletes' growth in like the 80s. They had growth plate injuries. So it is possible to damage a growth plate with doing, you know, 100 kilo clean and jerk for a 12-year-old. Absolutely, you can damage the growth plates. But growth plates are actually pretty hard to damage. If you want to damage a growth plate, you can't do it with non-ballistic resistance training. So if I'm doing a squat, a deadlift, anything, a lunge, any of those movements, unless I'm getting air, unless I'm doing a jump squat and landing with stiff knees, like it requires a real jarring force. So depth jumps, so plyometrics, if you're up on a big step, jumping down to the ground and treating it like hot coals and you mess that up, yeah, you can totally damage your growth plates. But the stunting the growth is not really a thing.
Yep.
And in fact, let's say we've got identical twins. And let's say they're 14, so really hitting that, if it's a boy, really hitting that growth spurt time.
Yep.
The weight trained, and one's weight training, one's not. The weight trained twin, they are going to have stronger muscles, better patterns. They're going to actually absorb the kinetic energy with their muscles, with the quads, glutes, calves, adductors. And so their growth plates are going to have less force going into them than the non-weight trained. So it's not just that it doesn't stunt your growth. Good resistance training, good weight training actually protects your growth plates.
Yeah, right.
As well as the tendons, which is important.
Which matters. So I suppose how much is too much at those younger ages?
Yeah. So in the young ages, I think it's all about making great shapes.
Yep.
So we don't need to be lifting really heavy weights. I am seeing an alarming trend of 12-year-olds doing, you know, 1.8 times body weight. It's like, that's not. And people having like bone injuries to the like neck bones from the weight resting on. I had a coach talking about to me about that just like a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, age appropriate. Like, so if you're a 12-year-old, body weight or maybe like an 8 kilo goblet squat, like just enough weight to feel the weight, but not much.
Yep.
But yeah, if everyone on the younger end of the scale just chases really good shapes,
yep.
We don't need to be lifting the house. Just make a really good squat shape, really good hinge shape, execute a really good push up.
Yep.
I would say on the push ups too, if you can keep the kids doing push ups well from a young age. It's really beneficial because I did a session last week with a club and it was the full age group, like all the way through. And so the littlest ones, the 9-year-olds, were actually much better at their push-ups than the 11 and 12-year-olds. Yeah, because their body grows and the strength doesn't keep pace with the growth of the body.
Yep.
And then particularly for the girls, they feel like they can't do it and they lose heart and it's a real shame. Whereas if you can keep them, if you look at a 9-year-old doing a good job or a 10-year-old, they can do a good quality push-up and you keep them doing that throughout that growth phase, that's a huge advantage they've got. So body weight stuff, shapes, and it might be just twice a week, but like, you know, for 15 minutes.
Yep.
It could be a squat supersetted with a push-up for 3 sets of 12 and then some calf raises.
Yep.
That's actually a huge developmental advantage that athlete is getting.
Yep.
And again, I'll send you links, which has got video instruction on how to do that stuff as well.
Yep.
But yeah, that's simple stuff, and then just build slowly.
Yeah, brilliant. So, what's the rest time, I suppose, between like if a young athlete was going to do that twice a week?
Yep.
You're looking at about 3 days between.
Yeah. Ideally, you want a bit of space.
Yep.
48-hour minimum. So you never want to do something on a Monday. You never want to do push-ups on a Monday, then do them on a Tuesday. You at least want to make it Monday, Wednesday.
Yeah, cool. Definitely. So. With push-ups in general,
yep.
Is there any difference between like open hand push-ups, on your knuckles push-ups, like wide, narrow?
Yeah.
Like, is there any difference between any of those?
Great question. I want to take it back. I forgot to answer your question probably about the weight training benefits.
Yep.
So I think if I talk about that first, it'll make choices with push-ups make more sense.
Okay.
Yep. So when we think of weight training, often people just think of going to the gym and looking good. That's just a thing. But in terms of performance, the benefits are just ridiculous. So a good weight training program, if we use upper body horizontal push, so push-up pattern as an example, you're going to throw your passes are going to be flat, zippy passes. You're going to have more shooting range. You're going to have more shoulder stability for better overhead rebounding. You are going to just have everything be better for having done those movements. So there's huge, huge benefits. And particularly just in contests, like wrestling, you know, moving people, being able to shove someone so fast the ref doesn't see.
We don't do that, Darryl. Come on. It's not how we teach our players to fight.
But, being overall stronger. And the push-ups are great movement for that, because you can't do a good push-up if you don't have good thoracic control. So if your thoracic, if your rib cage part of your spine is really tight or weak or not in control, you can't do a good push-up. If you don't have good lumbar control, good core strength and stability, you also can't execute a good push-up. So it has these prerequisites that make you have to get good at important things. So there's a lot to be said for it. I think it's one of the most important. It's one of the most important things. We have it as one of the central pieces we want our NPP athletes, you know, the pointy end of things, to be really good at executing high quality, really strict push-ups. So that's kind of setting the scene. So it's really valuable. And just from a lower body point of view, just because it makes sense to talk about that, things you're doing like squats, all those sorts of things, just getting the tissues stronger is part of it. Like, it's really good to increase the resilience of the tissues, but then getting the entire system stronger so it is absorbing the impact of sport better, so you're creating a body that's more load tolerant. So you can therefore throw more load at it and that body thrives rather than just survives. So circling back to the push-ups.
Hand position.
Yep. Yeah. I think you want to have a moderate width. The super wide ones, it's more pecky, less tricep-y, and they're just awkward, and they just don't feel that nice on your shoulders. Super narrow is more tricep-y. I think that middle ground is the sweet spot, where they're just wide enough that you can exert a good force. It's a similar position that you would reflexively take if you were shoving someone or something. And I think that's generally the right spot. The big thing is getting the appropriate range of motion. So athletes grow up doing push-ups as punishments. So they learn to avoid the range of motion. And so they do this really shallow, like most push-ups that I see performed by basketballers are like, at best they're doing 40% of a push-up. They're missing out on all that deep range of motion. And the deep range of motion is actually where you're getting more of the muscular stimulus, because muscles are better stimulated in a lengthened range of motion than a shortened. So you really want people to get good range. I enforce that by having people use a disposable coffee cup. So you've got to put that on your sternum, and you've got to get the chest all the way down to that. And all of a sudden, people that reckon they could do, you know, 20 push-ups can actually do four.
Yep.
Because you make them do the full.
Hey, I'd take four. That makes a lot of sense. Where am I going? I'm just going through my list of questions that came in. So big thanks to all the people that sent in questions this week. What are the common mistakes in S&C that boys and girls make?
Not getting the dance with failure correct. So what I mean by that is what we want is we want good proximity to failure when we're weight training. If you pick up a weight, bench press for an example. If I pick up 2 4-kilo dumbbells and I bench that, there's just no way I can achieve proximity to failure. Like, there's no way I can ask. It's just too easy. And so if you're not close to failure, you're not getting the stimulation to the muscles. You're not forcing a stress. It's not an adaptive response. Yep. Therefore, it's a complete waste of time. It's a warm-up set. And so you look around the whole country, and if you could magically do an audit of every gym, of every rep of bench done in Australia, right?
Yep.
What you would find is that almost every rep and every set are actually technically just warm-ups, because they're not close enough to failure to actually elicit a training response.
Yep.
Therefore, you're just warming up. So that's part of it, is that people aren't quite close enough. And then the other part is they get too close. So if you're always training absolutely to failure, it's pretty taxing on your nervous system, taxing on your joints, and you're not going to make great progress. The sweet spot is probably where you've got like maybe one rep in the tank, two reps in the tank. So you're training pretty hard, but you're getting that adaptation. So for juniors, you know, 12 reps, you know, three sets of 12 reps, where getting that 12th is possible, but it's still a struggle and it's still reasonably tidy.
Yep.
So we know that's probably means you probably had maybe two or three more in the tank. And that's a good way to think about it. And there's a good, so RPE, which is rate of perceived exertion, is, I find, a terrible way of having people self-assess. Because you say, how hard was that? And everyone just goes, quite hard, felt like about a 7. Like, I just don't feel like you get good answers in the gym. there's another version called reps in reserve-based RPE. So what that is you work out, you kind of get a sense of how many you had in the tank. So if you had 3 in the tank, that would be a reps in reserve RPE of a 7.
Okay.
If you had 2 in the tank, that would be an 8. If you had none in the tank, that would be a 10. So you're just flipping the maths. And that's really good because the beauty of that is that you can do a reality check. And so what you can do is you can AMRAP it, which is where you do as many reps as possible. That's one of my favorite things to do in the gym. Right. So you take an athlete. So we had an example a couple of weeks ago, an athlete in the gym, really strong. Just, you know, those athletes that just look at a weight and they get stronger. Yep. And she's an absolute weapon. She was benching 15 kilos each hand, which, you know, externally that looks quite decent for a young teenager. But I could just tell she was just not even in second gear. So I said, I want you to just this next set, just bust out as many as you can. Just go till you can't go anymore. And so she got 26 reps. And what that means is there was, you know, a lot of reps in reserve. And that was a warm-up set. So that athlete could have easily kept on going for a whole year, and the entire year was just warm-ups.
Yep.
Reps in reserve, a couple in the tank is a really good way of going. And enough reps that you're getting a tissue adaptation. So if you're trying to do chins and you just do 2 chins and then rest for 5 minutes and then do 2 chins, any adaptation you're getting is just neural. It's just the brain getting better at asking the nervous system to ask the muscles to work. And neural adaptations are good. And there's a time and a place where sometimes you don't want someone to put extra muscle on. They're too muscly. And so then you just want neural adaptations. But for most of our juniors, a little bit of tissue building, a bit of a capacity building is really good. So 12 is great.
Yeah, cool. So how much physical activity should players be doing per week? Is there a magic number on this?
No magic number.
Never is.
Often athletes have got pretty – young athletes have high volumes because they can be multi-sport, they can be multi-team. It's not – to me it's not so much about a fixed number for everyone, but what I would say is you want to get a minimum of 1 day a week where you get some bone rest. I think that's a really good guideline. We just try and find a day where you just don't do anything. And in a perfect world, it would probably be 2 days. That's difficult to find in juniors. But it might be that it's 1 day of total and 1 day of like half court level in basketball, just sort of lower intensity, catch and shoot. So you're doing a bit of work, but it's kind of a light day.
Yep.
I think it's more important to think about rest days than total hours.
Yeah.
Okay. But having said that, like I'll never forget, this was probably a decade ago. Had a 6'9" BV, big, and we have deloaded him because we're going into nationals, and obviously you want to perform at nationals. The coaches cut back the training volume. Everyone around this athlete has done everything they can to do the real Bart Cummings, like to really do a racehorse, not workhorse approach to this. And he comes in, and I don't know, we're like 6 days out. It's like, oh, I'm really sore. I'm not sure I can lift properly today. And I'm like, why are you sore? He's like, oh, I did 9 games of netball yesterday.
Yeah, it's a good decision.
And yes. I was filthy, you know, because we're doing everything we can to optimize. And, you know, so I think it's more about learning to say no to that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's not so much about worrying about precise hours. It's just doing the stuff that will develop and advance you and trying to avoid the stuff that's probably a distraction at best.
Yep, I really like that. Is there a preference for lifting weights in the morning or at night? Is there any difference between the two?
Yeah, there are physiological, psychological, and logistical differences.
Yep.
And so I'll give you an example. So technically, if you said, what's the very best time to train in the day, I'd probably say about 4 o'clock because your testosterone is quite high, your cortisol is quite low.
Yep.
It's not a bad time to train. But what if you're the end of a school day and you're cooked and your training is going to be crap?
Yep.
So, it's great that your testosterone is, 3% higher. But if your drive and freshness is way lower, it's a waste of time. So I think generally it's just whenever's the time when you're going to train well consistently.
Yep.
So for me, I am a rubbish afternoon trainer because I get to the end of the day, I'm like, oh, I just can't be bothered. Whereas if I do it first thing in the morning before I've had a chance to say no, that drives really good consistency. So for me, mornings work really well. I think for basketballers, most of the time it probably should be afternoons and evenings because it's almost it almost never happens that basketballers get early nights. Often the, you know, you get a late Friday night game. You might have training finishing as late as 9 o'clock for some athletes.
Yep.
And then you're all adrenalized and you can't get to sleep properly till 11.
Yep.
So I think in general, afternoon is going to be better for your typical basketball. For your typical executive or parent, I think morning is almost always better because it actually happens.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point you make, actually. It's I notice when I like lift or go for walks or anything like that in the afternoon, generally I tend to lift heavier stuff or my walk pace is quicker. Mm. So it lines up with exactly what you're saying. Like post 4 p.m., I tend to be in a better spot. But it's also the first one I'm going to can when stuff gets busy. And it's like, I'll miss that. Whereas if I've done it first thing in the morning, I tend to be okay. Like it's done, it's banked. I'm good.
I think it's much better. Yeah. Also, there's, and this is not particularly relevant to the athletic population, but I think it's interesting just for people to be aware of. There's definitely a phenomenon where if you, let's say you're at work and someone offers you chocolate cake.
Yep.
I love chocolate cake.
Yes, don't we all?
Someone offers you chocolate cake and you're training in the evening, you will tend to say, yeah, cool, I'm training tonight, no worries, burn that off. A, probably won't, but B, if you flip that and you've trained that morning, it's often people are actually more likely to go, no, I didn't get out of bed at 6:30. I didn't go brave the cold to train just to undo that work with the chocolate cake. So you're exploiting a phenomenon of human psychology called sunk cost, which is we value stuff we've already have or have created.
Yep.
A little side note, but I think morning trainings help with that a lot too.
Yeah, it's also why I have crippling credit card debt. Like it's it's much easier to spend the money you don't have than the money you do have already that's invested there. What matters more, weights, reps, or sets?
This is a great question. I love it.
Yeah.
So what matters most is, are you training at an intensity level where you're getting the right adaptation you're chasing? So if you're trying to make a shape, if you're a 12-year-old trying to learn how to make a squat shape, we want a really lightweight so that you have the time and space to create a beautiful shape and lay down that pattern. So for that athlete, weight training is more like practicing your shooting, like, you know, Steph Curry style from like, you know, a meter away from the basket, like really getting that shot shape perfect and then take it out. So for that athlete, you want light enough that you can perfect the technique is going to be much, much better.
Yep.
You've got a 16-year-old who actually wants to grow a bit of muscle because they're pretty skinny and they're getting, you know, shoved around in the paint. Well, you need to be actually having enough weight that you can just get out those 12 reps with that 1 to 2 in the tank, like you're trying to build capacity. Critically, what gets missed all the time is people focus a lot on the reps, but they don't focus enough on the rest time. So let's say that 16-year-old is benching 20 kilos a hand and they're doing it for a perfect 12 and that is absolutely spot on, 2 in the tank, you're like, great. If they go rest for 6 minutes though, by the time they come back, the work to rest ratio is such that they're not going to stimulate an adaptation because they've allowed too much rest to accumulate. So you want relatively short rest, but not too short because otherwise then you can't do it. So
just doing more reps.
So around the sort of 2 to 4 minute mark, somewhere in there, and people can use their judgment. They'll get a feel for it.
Yep.
I find if I rest less than 2.5 minutes, my next set's pretty crap. And then it was like, well, what was the point? Like, I can't get enough work in for there to be a stimulus.
Yep.
We design our programs at Core Advantage to get around 3 to 4 minutes rest most of the time because that's a good balance between neural gains and muscular gains.
Yep.
And how we do that is, you know, you'll do a squat and you'll superset that with chin-ups. And so your legs are resting while you're doing the chin-ups and then you come back and you're in continuous motion.
Yep.
Worst thing you can do, particularly with a group of athletes, is have them do a thing and then sit around because they just lose momentum.
Yep.
So we'll do supersets, so that's A and B, or even a tri-set, so A, B, C. So you might do squats, chins, planks, or something like that. So you're doing three things and then finishing them all off and then moving on to the next series.
Yeah, okay, cool. The breakdown of cardio versus weight benefit. Is there one over the other that you would recommend for basketballs?
Yeah. I think it always has to come back to what are you missing? What's the empty bucket?
Yep.
So if you've got – it's just that you basically never get basketballers with an empty cardio bucket because they're playing the game.
Yep.
So that bucket's going to be at least 80% full because you're running up and down a court. You're doing cardio because it's your sport.
Yep.
But it's amazing how empty the strength bucket can be.
Yep.
And particularly when you compare it to pros. So, you know, I'm lucky enough to train, you know, some really high level athletes. And you look at their schedule and like, you know, Jock Landale, 30% of his training week will be, you know, body stuff,
yep.
you know, and strength stuff because they need that stuff. So, it's focused on the empty bucket, and the empty bucket is almost always, strength. But it's just giving it a pinch, you know,
yep.
twice a week, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever you can do. Anything's better than nothing.
Yep. Really like it. What matters more, recovery or prehab?
Mm.
Like if you had to pick one, like obviously both.
Yeah, I think I would pick prehab.
Yep.
Because if you're doing a great job with prehab, if you've got, and I'm defining prehab pretty broadly.
Yep.
It's just getting stronger, getting better muscle activation, just getting better resilience in the tissues. So it's a little broad.
Yep.
But if you're doing a good job with that prehab stuff, you're going to have much higher load tolerance, and therefore you won't need the recovery as much because the load tolerance is higher. And the single most important part of recovery is actually just time.
Yeah.
It's sleep and time, and you're going to get that anyway. So, you know, at the moment, ice baths.
The new thing.
They are having a moment,
yep.
right? And the hilarious thing is, at best, I reckon they're like a 4 or 5% at best, probably more like a 1%.
Yep.
But also a lot of people are doing them because it makes you feel kind of like a badass. Like you feel like you feel like a pro.
It's interesting this because I did some training earlier in the year before I came and saw you actually, which just fixed me up to a large degree with some calf problems.
Yep.
And went to the physio and sort of said, hey, look, this is the situation. He's like, have you been doing ice baths by any chance? And I said, yeah, I have. Why? Said, well, it's made you feel too good.
Mm.
Like you feel like you can go again quicker, and consequently your body wasn't ready for the additional load to be thrown on there straight away. And all this time I've been thinking ice baths, fantastic. When it turns out it was actually a little bit of a masking agent for the body's not quite right yet. It just makes you feel good if you had to go right now.
And it's actually worse than a masking agent too in the sense that it's blocking your anabolic response. So what we want to do a dose of resistance training. And we want to get an inflammatory response because the inflammatory response tells the body, you know, there's a problem, you're not strong enough. The body responds to that with an anabolic response and it builds muscle tissue. So if you said to me, hey, I want to train really hard, but I want to minimize my gains, I would say get in an ice bath after every lift.
Yeah,
so ice baths have been proven as an inflammatory and anabolic blocker. So they're very useful in certain scenarios, right? So I was helping out the Geckos, the Australian deaf women's team, earlier in the year, and we were doing it during the tournament. So they would do a game, they'd come down to Foundry, where we're operating now, and we would do ice baths there. And that was profoundly, that wasn't a 1 or 2%, that was profoundly beneficial for them because they felt great, they were good to go for the next game. You wanted them to feel great.
Yeah.
And you're not particularly trying to get adaptations in a tournament week, you're just trying to get through.
Yep.
Ice baths like once or twice a week.
Yep.
And pretty much never after your resistance training. The amount of people I see go put in a really good training session.
Yep.
And they've nailed their proximity to failure. They've picked the right exercise. They've done everything right.
Yep.
And then they go jump in an ice bath. And you're like,
that's
not the right move.
And you talk about it there. Like you've put in a really good shift. You then go and undo everything.
Yeah.
And look, it is. It's mental. Like it's, you know, you build yourself up to it. There's a sense of accomplishment and I got through it. I must be feeling like $1 million, but you're potentially undoing a lot of the...
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
What about the other fad that's sort of coming through, like saunas?
Like you're reading my mind.
Ah, brilliant.
Yeah, so saunas are the real deal. Saunas are amazing. So we're really lucky in that we've got the population of Finland, where basically everyone has a sauna.
Yep.
So it's a huge population with amazing longitudinal data on the benefits. And so the benefits are huge reduction in all-cause mortality, Alzheimer's, all these things that just go wrong with your body don't happen if you sauna consistently. It's the best way to get a perfectly healthy and natural elevation in your growth hormone, yep. which is a really good recovery anabolic hormone.
Yep.
So saunas are incredible. So perfect scenario. This is not for kids. Kids don't thermoregulate yep. as well as adults.
Okay.
So I should make it really clear. I yep. don't think this is for kids. This is for seniors, but for people 18 and over, I suppose.
Yep.
But yeah, the perfect scenario is you might do, if you need to, if you're backing up, maybe you've got a Friday game and then you've got a Sunday game because you're playing NBL 1 or something. Yeah,
yep.
ice bath is going to be useful on that Friday night.
Yep.
But the sauna, each time you lift, if you just go do a 20-minute sauna afterwards, providing you're not one of those people who loses heaps and heaps of electrolytes. If you're a massive sweater,
yep.
saunaing, you're just going to make yourself cramp prone. Yep. But providing you're not, yeah, you're going to get an elevation of growth hormone. And what you're getting to is, it's kind of like yoga for your blood vessels.
Yeah,
you're getting okay. this really nice stretch for your blood vessels. You're sweating out the heavy metals like benzene. There's certain heavy metals that in our modern environment our bodies absorb.
Yep.
And the only way to get them out is sweat.
Yeah, okay.
And so that's probably part of why it reduces the Alzheimer's risk right. and all these other things. So, yeah, saunas are amazing. I desperately want one for my home gym.
we don't have any sponsors on the show, I'm afraid, Durham. We'll see what we can do for you.
But yeah, I think they're great. And often people then ask infrared versus real.
Yep.
I don't know. Yeah. I just have to short circuit a few emails about this. I don't know because all the data is on the real ones because the Finnish ones are the traditional style.
Yep.
It may well be that the infrared ones are just as good, but we just don't have the data. So yep. I would tend in that case to go with the data.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Interesting tangent that we tend to go on when we talk about these sorts of things. Penalties at training sessions. What can they look like? Obviously, don't send them on a lap around all 10 courts of the State Basketball Centre or anything like that, but what can they look like?
Do you know, I think it's interesting. I think the best coaches make penalties just, it's minimal effective dose of penalty because yep. they just want to make the team that didn't try or that lost, they kind of just want to make you do a thing where you kind of marking yourself as kind of the loser of the drill or, you know,
I need you to know you've lost. Like right? this inconvenience attached to it.
Yeah. So I remember when I was with back in the day when it was the Bullion Boomers and Tom Maher was the coach. And he's a crazy genius, Tom.
Yep.
And he was like, yeah, I just need them to know they've lost. So we would just do 3 push-ups as a penalty.
Yep.
And that's a good penalty because you're building a bit of capacity, you're getting a thing you want. There's something about being made to kind of go on the ground. It feels a bit like you're the loop while the others stand around.
Yep.
And it's not doing any harm. So, for instance, I much prefer that to burpees. I don't like a burpee. Burpees, it's just kind of a, I don't know, it's a casserole movement. It's a whole bunch of things at once. I don't
easy way to feel dizzy.
Yeah. I don't think it's particularly good. But I think 3 crisp push-ups is a really good penalty. Even like star jumps, just anything that just is, that group was the loser, but not something that's, I mean, the worst is when you make them run really hard penalties and it's like, well, now they're going to lose the next one too.
Yes, I'm spent.
It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
What else do we have left? VJBL warm-up, working anywhere between 3 to 5 minutes. What could the players be doing?
Yeah, this is a tough one.
Yep.
All right, I'm going to outline best case first.
Yep.
So best case would be you find somewhere quiet in the stadium where you can do a little bit of a roll and a stretch, the starting points of warm-up 2.0, which again will be in the resources.
Yep.
That's going to loosen off muscle tissue. That's going to just get you ready to go. And so you could do foam roll, tiny little stretch, and a little bit of squats. Now you're a little bit activated.
Yep.
Then what would be ideal is to do a warm-up 2.0 dynamic movement routine. But the problem is that you want to make sure you're allowing enough time to actually have a basketball in your hands, pass to your teammates, shoot the ball. So it might be that you do an abbreviated version. So the full version takes, I don't know, about 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Yep.
And that might eat up too much of your time. So you might just do the first half of it. Or you might do, because it has a skip, a single leg RDL. I would always do the RDLs, the walking arabesques, because they're an anti-ankle rolling, anti-ACL drill.
Yep.
And so if you just wake up that balance system prior to playing, you're now less likely to roll an ankle. So that would be non-negotiable. I'd do that. And then maybe do a bit of A-skip, which is, again, a drill we've got videos for, and then some ninja landings.
Yep.
So run and jump. So at least you've covered off sprinting, everything in there. Jumping, balancing, yep. And it's not perfect, but at least those systems are awake, and then you can get on and actually do the basketball. Also, you can be creative. There's no reason you couldn't take the other drills that you missed out, and maybe while one group's doing layups, the other drill does that in the layup line, going in yep. to get the ball. You know, there's ways you can kind of mix them in as well.
Yep.
A pinch of work is good.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and just something is better than nothing
yeah.
at the moment. Yeah. Like, so many of our coaches, this is not a crack at coaches before anyone accuses me of that. We grab them 15 minutes before the game and we talk to them for 15 minutes. And it's like, how much do we really think they're taking in when they could be doing something a little bit more meaningful in that time to just get them ready? And look, we know the last 3 minutes of a game can go from anywhere from 3 minutes through to 15 to 20 mm-hmm. minutes, depending on what's going on. But just use our time a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, I think that's great advice.
Yep,
yeah.
Excellent. So you've kind of answered trying to increase vertical leap, will it lead to injury, your impact overuse? You've really answered that yeah. one along the way.
Well, just to expand, just to make it crystal clear, because it's a great yep. question. I think it's good to remember that there's one of the best ways to increase vertical leap, particularly for 50% of the population, for the girls, is to practice jumping.
Yep.
Because girls tend not to like showing off. Therefore, they tend yep. not to like practicing jumping because it looks like showing off. So a really simple thing is you do the warm-up at training, and then you get the girls to do a 2-foot jump where they try and touch the net.
Yep.
And they could all each do that 3 times. It'll take you 2 minutes, and you will see your team improve their vertical leap just because you made them do 3 reps, two to three times a week of jumping.
Yep.
And it's very safe, and it's actually a chance for them to practice their landing technique. Which is going to reduce their potential for ACL injury.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just overdoing it's the problem. Yeah. But a pinch of it, just magic.
It's interesting you said that because I saw a video clip the other day where the coach had brought like a little mini basketball in with a tennis mm-hmm. ball.
Yep.
And just would hold it up there and, you know, go practice your dunks. Like just yeah. dumb little stuff. And one, great vibe to the session straight away because yeah. the kids were all trying to outdo each other on the way through. But two, they didn't realize they were practicing trying to jump high,
yeah.
which is a thing. But also the landing part is such a massive part of it.
Huge.
The amount of times you come down in a game, not with the perfect you know, landing base or anything like that. It's however the space around you allows. It's not always perfect.
Yeah.
You got to find a way.
You got to find a way. Yeah. Yep. And if you've grooved good technique, you've made it easier to yep. find a way because you're going to tend to absorb that kinetic energy better.
Yep.
But you're also going to have times where someone bumps you, you're spinning through the air, and you've just got to get good at kind of improvising and doing a good landing under duress.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. We are coming into the dangerous time of year where our yeah. workload has been as high can possibly get. We get a magical couple of weeks off here when our kids sit there and say, this is couch time, where I'm going to do nothing because this is the time where my body grows, recovers, etc. And then they come back into tournaments and then spike.
Yep.
This is a problem.
This is a terrible problem.
Yeah. So what would you recommend from a summer loading and deloading?
Yeah. So to frame it up, it's actually the worst it's ever been.
Yep.
Because you know, when you and I were young, yes, we would have sports deload, but there was nothing but The Price is Right on telly.
Yeah.
There was nothing else to do. Yep. So we would have a sports deload, but we would run around, we'd do other things, we'd ride bikes, we'd stayed very active in our non-sports time.
Yep.
We've now got a situation where it's almost like some of these young athletes are a bit like Formula One cars. Like they're on for the race,
yep.
and then they're very much not because they're on screens
yep.
not doing anything. So it's a real problem because you build 48 weeks increasing your load tolerance, getting your fitness, getting your strength, getting your capacity up. And then in 2 weeks, you can wash so much of that off and you find that you're now 6 weeks behind just with a couple of weeks of rest.
Yep.
So it's absolutely mission critical that every athlete does something. So you might finish and give yourself 4 days of nothing.
Yep.
Because that can be actually really handy because a few little grumpy things can calm the hell down. And then you start a really slow, smooth reload of doing some work. And it might be that normally you have, I don't know, 12 hours or 14 hours of sport.
Yep.
And you just find a way to try and make it, you know, like 4 to 6. Just something. But it's got to be similar to what you were doing in the sport. So you know, basketball is you're running 16 meters foul line to foul line. It's a
yep.
very short distance, and that's mostly accelerative biomechanics. And so running 5,000 meters really slowly to to maintain your capacity at running 16 meters. It just doesn't happen because you're actually running with a different shape, the same muscles, tendons. They're not getting the same stimulus.
Yep.
So you want to try and replicate game stress just in much lower doses because, you know, it's unreasonable to try and match the normal volume. That would suck.
Yep.
But just enough that your tissues kind of don't forget, for want of a better term.
Yep.
So again, I'll send you with a link to our app, yep, the Quarter-Vantage Interval Timer. And look, we built this specifically for summer homework because we got, yep, fed up with our athletes not doing the work. So we're like, you know what, we'll put it in an app. And you can just follow the bouncing ball. And that includes a drill I made in 2006 for the Australian Sapphires when I was, yep, the high performance manager there, called Game Fit, which is a match simulation.
Yep, it's so brilliant. I love it.
It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, I really love it.
Yeah, I love how it still gets, like, I spent a lot of time designing it back then and workshopping it. And then it's just basically, stands the test of time. Yep. People still use it and get great results.
Yeah, there are times we use it for penalties. Where we sort of sit, yeah, there and say, hey, we're having a light week this week and we're not training, but we are going to all come in and do this together just to kind of simulate a little bit of it. But it is brilliant over the course of, we need to do something, but not everything.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
it's enough to very much get a sweat on.
Yeah.
There's no problem with that.
Yeah.
But it is also movements that you would experience on a basketball court.
Yeah.
So for mine, it's one of the best ones we've got out there. So yeah,
that's awesome.
Absolutely recommend it. Darren, how can people get in touch with you? Because there has been a little bit of movement in the Core Advantage world, yeah, of late. So how do people find you now?
Yeah. So our Instagram page is, yep, is something that I still run and check. You can find me at Durham, D-U-R-H-A-M, at coreadvantage.com.au. And yeah, so to be clear, so Core Advantage still very much exists. So I'm, yep, still I'm still running all the consulting and the contracts and all that stuff that I'm doing with athletes. So that's very much a thing. So I'm working with a bunch of different clubs across different sports. Our new home base is at Foundry Athletic, which is an amazing facility. So that's where we've kind of transplanted our athletic population and our coaching staff into there as well. But we're still very much a thing.
Okay. Excellent. So would highly recommend any parents that are unsure about this, go and have a look in particular, because there's always a wealth of information up on the Core Advantage page, but it is also a massive priority with our high-performance athletes now that we need them to have better bodies,
yeah,
just from a durability perspective, but also if they want to perform further,
yeah,
they need to be able to be in a position where they can. So this has kind of been the missing ingredient, I think, for a lot of years where we've all sort of sit there and said, oh, you know, strength and conditioning matters, but how much has been the thing. And, you know, we don't want it overdoing the basketball and superseding, but it's a core function of what we do. And if we have athletes that can get on court more often, then we can do more things with them as opposed to trying to rehab an injury because we didn't look after them in the first place.
Avoidance is so much easier. Prevention is so much better than cure. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I really like it. Darren, thank you very much for jumping in. Greatly appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.